Something's happening to me.
You're turning black and white, and you've got really ugly glasses on.
Well, you're suddenly wearing dumpy clothes, and you've got this weird, frowny mouth.
There's some kind of chart behind you about...
Ebola! Because I'm really worried that I have Ebola.
I'm feeling an anxiety that has no obvious locus.
Greg, I think I know what this is. I definitely recognize the visual signature.
We're trapped in a Roz Chast cartoon?
Yes, she's drawing us right now.
I feel so... worried.
No, don't. Our anxiety is ratcheting up the power of her vision.
Right. If we calm down, maybe the cartoon will go away.
Okay, deep breath. And let it out.
Oh, wow. I felt my diaphragm catch on something. That's not right. I think there might be something wrong with my diaphragm.
No, Greg, no. You're playing right into her hands.
Maybe we've always been in a Roz Chast cartoon. Maybe we just didn't know it until now. Our whole existences have been just one small joke on page 34 of The New Yorker.
Please, Greg, don't let your thoughts go there. You're just making her smile at her drafting table.
I've got to get out!
Greg, no! Oh my God, he jumped. Look what you did to him, Roz. I hope you're happy. What am I saying? You're never happy. That's the whole point. If I made you happy, then maybe you'd have to free me. Hey, Roz, you look awesome. Do you want some Necco wafers? No, okay, this isn't working. Let's just hear the interview. And now he dressed up as Eustace Tilly. Again, Colin McEnroe.
It's not something I do more than 3 or 4 times a year because I'm uncomfortable in a monocle. All right, we are down in the New Haven studios yet again. We love it here in the New Haven studios, and we're so excited. Roz Chast is here with us. So is Jeremy Clough, sometimes known as Peter. He's the manager of media services at the Norman Rockwell Museum. Roz Chast, do I have to tell you who Roz Chast is? She's a New Yorker cartoonist. She's the author of several books, including her award-winning graphic memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Or as I, a person who has had to deal with the end of his parents' lives. Think about it, PTSD in a binder. Actually, it's a wonderful, wonderful rendering and unbelievably familiar to me about what it is like to deal with your parents at the end of their lives. But then, Roz Chast, so many things about you are familiar to me because I was born in October of 1954. You were born in November of 1954. We were both only children. I'm basically Roz Chast with no cartooning skills. And I think also we shared a sense. I mean, actually, you use in the book the phrase unhappy childhood. And I think it's not that for either of us that we had unhappy childhoods so much as that we were unhappy children, right? Like nobody was hitting us with a stick or anything like that.
No, speak for yourself. No, I think you're right. I think I was, you know, sort of I was kind of a cranky kid.
Well, also maybe a sense that, like, I was the one who was, like, whispering to you as you were being born. Like, I'd just gotten out of the womb. That was the voice you heard saying, stay in there. It's really scary out here.
No, it wasn't so good in there either.
Okay. You didn't like it there?
No.
You actually remember not liking it there.
Yeah, it was crowded.
Right.
You know, it was dark. It was hot.
But there's also this sense, I think, you know, a lot of children have these, I mean, maybe the other children are lying to us, but it seems as though they have these carefree childhoods.
They're always skipping.
Yeah.
A lot of skipping, you know, happy children, singing little songs, skipping. Right.
What is with the skipping?
I have no idea.
Stop with the skipping.
Yeah. Free and easy.
Yeah. So you, like, at what point, how old were you when you had identified yourself as a worrier, as a person who was worried about things? Do you even remember your first worry?
I don't remember exactly the first worry, but I do remember being about 4 years old and knowing the word anxiety, which I thought was pronounced anxiety. And I knew what it was.
Yeah. I mean, you had an intuitive grasp of it.
I had a lot of anxiety.
Yeah. Nobody had to explain that to you.
No, not at all. But I think I learned, you know, from the master.
Right.
Or masters, you know, both of my parents were very anxious people and, you know, the kind of culture of anxiety. I don't think they invented it. You know, they got it from their parents. It's, you know, the Philip Larkin poem.
Right. Which we cannot say that poem on public radio.
No, we cannot.
I understand that. But we know which poem you mean.
Yeah.
And I mean, and in a way, one of the things you do in the book is kind of suggest, in cartoon form, that kind of anxiety is, it has like historical roots, right? Because people in Russia were anxious about getting their throats cut or something like that, and it just sort of kind of keeps going forward.
I don't understand why more people aren't anxious. You know, just kind of like when I watch the news, it's like earthquake here, you know, terrorist attack there. Or maybe they are. Maybe we just don't, you know, but you do get the feeling that enough bad stuff goes on in the world that it's amazing we're not all just kind of like, I'm never going outside again. I'm never going to do anything again, because clearly that just leads to trouble.
That's our version of Old MacDonald. With an earthquake there and a terrorist attack there, an earthquake, there a terrorist attack. It's hard to say. By the way, we're live here in the afternoon. If you are a Rozcast fan and you want to express some deep felt anxiety to her, might not even be a really good idea, but our number is 203-776-9677, 203-776-WNPR, if you like to spell with your phone. What's it like when you meet your fans, when you do a book signing or something like that? What do they say to you?
Well, with this particular book, the parent's memoir, so many people have gone through this or are going through this. And I also meet a lot of, when I first started doing talks on this book, I was very worried to meet, you know, when I would see people who were, you know, clearly not people my age, but people who were a lot older. They were like, you know, 85 or 90. And I thought, like, I hope that they're not mad at me for writing this book. Mm. But on the contrary, a lot of them are glad that, you know, it's being talked about. Mm. And, you know, they went through it with their parents. And so that was, I was happy about that and relieved, you know. Usually it's very nice to meet people who like the book or like my work.
I really like the book, but it did give me a mild case of PTSD just because so many of the things were, I mean, we've all been through that clean out the parents' apartment with all the weird stuff that you keep finding.
Well, I mean, I sort of have a, you know, there's a sort of selfish reason for this, that I saw this happen with my parents, and I think I don't really want this, the same exact thing to happen to me. Not that I know what to do about it, but I hope that by the time I get to that point, there will be more options, you know? And, you know, who knows whether there will or won't be, but I know that by never talking about it, by pretending that this doesn't exist, the situation gets crazier and crazier. I mean, I just had one of my best friends, her mother, about a week ago, passed away at the age of 102. Mm-hmm. And she had had a stroke. And the doctor at the hospital started talking. Oh, she was in a, I guess there's such a thing as a semi-coma, which I didn't know, but she was in a semi-coma. And the doctor started talking to my friend about, you know, bringing her mom home and physical therapy and speech therapy. And my friend just said, like, you know, she just said, what planet are you on? Mm-hmm. This woman is 102. She's been in horrible shape for the last year, and she just had a stroke. Mm-hmm. And she's not speaking. She doesn't recognize me. And she's in a semi-coma. And can't we talk about something like making her comfortable? Mm-hmm. Or what are you talking about, speech therapy?
I had to do the exact same thing in my mother's case. I mean, she had Alzheimer's disease, and then she'd fallen and broken her neck, and then she was like having this other cascading set of things, you know, and at a certain point I had to say to the doctor, oh no, this is like hospice, we're doing hospice now. And he didn't like that idea. He thought we would just like sort of keep intervening. And
Well, I mentioned in my book when my mother was 97 and she really hadn't gotten out of bed in months, and the doctor suggested that she have a colostomy operation, and that it wouldn't be any big deal. And I thought, well, I don't think this is really true, because I think that like any operation is probably somewhat of a big deal. The person's going to be put under general anesthesia. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you have a colostomy, if you have part of your intestine taken out, chances are you're going to be under general anesthesia. It's not going to be like a Novocaine shot.
Right.
And on top of that, what happens afterwards with managing that? And so I actually went online and I read, this is like really hilarious and a cheery conversation, but I went online and I read various, like, I have a colostomy operation blogs, which is such a thing. And it's not, even if you're at a otherwise healthy person in their 30s, managing your apparatus is not a nothing thing. And I just thought, I don't think I'll put my mother through that.
Right. You know? Well, and we promise this will turn so much cheerier at times anyway as we're talking. You know, I should mention, I don't know if I made this clear, but that one of the reasons that Jeremy Clough, sometimes known as Peter, from the Norman Rockwell Museum is here is because Roz Chass' cartoon memoirs is on view at the Norman Rockwell Museum up in Massachusetts now through October 26th. The exhibit is part of the museum's Distinguished Illustrator Exhibition Series. I just want to go back to one thing that you were saying because you know, just in the same sense that there was, I think, this completely unrealistic, skipping-oriented vision of childhood that we were was peddled to us. There's also sort of a death version of that, right? And I just have to tell you one quick story. I don't want to hear some more from you, but when my mother was dying, and my mother was not unlike your parents, particularly in the sense that she was often just kind of generally unhappy about things. And things were kind of never quite right. You know how when you're dying, you're supposed to see that light, you know, and you go towards the light and all that stuff?
Yeah.
My mother saw the light and she didn't like it and she wanted it turned off. And she started complaining about the light. I didn't want to say, Mom, this is a good light, right? You just, like, everybody wants the light.
Oh, that's funny.
She didn't even like the light.
Well, there's this great Jack Ziegler cartoon. He's a wonderful New Yorker cartoonist.
He's been on the show.
Yeah. And the one where, like, the guy finding that the light at the end of the tunnel is New Jersey. He's just running through the tunnel and it's like, oh, yeah. So maybe that's what she saw.
So, you know, you said you hope that there are better options when you're 90 years old. You know, Mike Wallace famously asked Woody Allen, do you want to live on in the memories of your fans? And he said, no, I want to live on in my apartment. So whenever your time comes, like, what would be a great option? What would be, like, you know, how would you like your life to run down?
Well, I've done a little bit of reading about the use of psychedelics at the end of life or in cases of terminal illness. And I'm very interested in that. I just feel like, you know, there are these other ideas out there that if we weren't so focused on keeping the body alive at all costs, including incredible pain to the person and humiliation and pain worse than humiliation because, you know, what is that compared to, you know, physical suffering? You know, there would be a lot of things that we would be talking about and thinking about. And I'm not talking about like, I'm going to like take this handful of LSD and like trip out. But something that like if there was some sort of people could study it and say, you know, what dosage is good? What do you do if the person is, you know, having experienced it? So that's terrible. What is the best setting in which to happen? You know, does this help anybody? What, you know, things like that, that we could really be talking about something kind of real instead of, you know, these skipping pretend versions of.
That sounds great to me. I mean, you and I both lived through pretty much the same era, which was this kind of included kind of a drug revolution. And I was too scared to take drugs. So, I mean, if I could do that at the end of my life.
Yeah.
I'd like to be at a rave on a walker. I want to try all those things that I was too afraid to take in college. Megan from Hamden has called in to talk to Roz Chast. Let's make that happen. Megan, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, my question was about coping with anxiety. I am one of many who's struggled with depression in my life and also some issues regarding, you know, self-confidence and self-image, and that has translated into my relationships with other people. And I find that something that happens is I end up getting a lot of just anxiety from those issues that get brought up, and if a relationship ends, which for me it recently did, I just sort of go into this mental spiral. And over the years through therapy, I've learned some coping strategies, but you know, every time it happens, it feels like I'm on the tipping point of basically descending into this vortex of unhealthy thoughts.
Now, Megan, you do understand that the person you're calling into right now is a cartoonist, right?
Yeah.
I mean, she may not be the most appropriate person, but I mean, I'm sure she would like to help you in some way.
Oh, no. I'm not asking for, like, you know, like, oh, please help me, like, dial a hotline. No, what I'm asking is, like, how does she cope with that? Like, does she find her art to be something that helps, or what coping strategy?
Megan, that is a great question. That's a great question. I'm going to throw it over to Roz.
I think having a good therapist is important. And if you trust him or her, and they, you know, psychopharmacology is an option and a necessity for some of us, and work, you know, work is really, for me, important.
We have just a little, here in the studio, is a little bar that we press with our paws, and a lorazepam comes out.
Yeah.
So that helps. You know, I mean, Jeremy Cloud, this is a time to weave you in an odd way, because, I mean, people think Roz Chast, Norman Rockwell, what could they possibly have in common? Well, turns out they have a lot in common, and she was just talking about therapy. One of the things we know about Norman Rockwell now is not only was he was in therapy with Eric Erickson.
That's true. That's what brought him to Stockbridge, where the museum is located. And it was actually his wife who originally was seeking treatment. And he would they were living in Vermont at the time, drive her back and forth. And so Stockbridge ended up being a suitable place to live and get treatment. And then he explored that himself, was very interested in psychology in his later work. I think you can see that.
Right. And so we know from the Deborah Solomon biography, this guy was, I mean, really different from what we think about him from his pictures. Roz, was that news to you? I mean, when you sort of, when you were tapped to be exhibited this way at the Norman Rockwell Museum, did you just think of Norman Rockwell as Mr. Happy Thanksgiving? I mean, talk about skipping.
Well, I actually had read the Deborah Solomon biography, and so I didn't think of him that way. He was really an amazing artist in a lot of ways. I mean, not just technically, but much more complex and nuanced than I think a lot of people think of him as, you know, if you just think of him as like happy Thanksgiving kind of, you know, sort of trite stuff.
Right. And he, yeah, I mean, in his art, he's dealing with stuff. And then in his life, it turns out he was like dealing with even more stuff. We're talking to Roz Chast right now. Our number 203-776-9677. It is not a hotline. She's not able to actually help you with your problems. At least we don't think so. 203-776-WNPR. Although that might be an interesting project, is do a show where you and two other cartoonists are there, and people could just call in with their problems, and you and Jack Ziegler and, you know, one other cartoonist would be there. And you just give, like, advice from cartoonists.
Yeah, well, you just, you have to, like, really lower your expectations. Like, get them down as low as possible. And then, you know, iced coffee is good. And, you know.
All right. That's the advice for the day. All right. So we're going to take a little break here. Or we're going to come back with more after the proverbial this. And we're back. We're back with Roz Chast, the New Yorker cartoonist, author of many books, including her award-winning graphic memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, which is about the aging institutionalization. Sounds like so institutional, but and ultimate deaths of her parents. It's funnier than I just made that sound, however. Also with us is Jeremy Clough, manager of the media services at the Norman Rockwell Museum, where Roz Chast's work, and not just the cartoons, and we will come to that, are on exhibit. We'll tell you more about the exhibit as we go along here, because there's much more up there than just cartoons. Not that cartoons wouldn't be a great way to spend an afternoon. They would for me anyway. You know, it's Roz Chast. I just heard that promo where they're talking about Tig Notaro and people thinking that she's their best friend. I've never been under the delusion that Roz Chast was my best friend, but when I started seeing your cartoons, because we are of a similar age and a similar temperament, I think, and I'm sure I share with a lot of people the sense, oh, this is somebody who's doing cartoons about my stuff. It's stuff that's I mean, I've never had to have a Roz Chast cartoon explained to me. You know, like I immediately know what you're talking about. And so even before this book came out, with its own special set of points of reference for people. I mean, you must get that from people, like, oh yeah, you're my cartoonist. You're the cartoonist who draws about my insomnia or whatever.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I heard the Tig Notaro little promo there, and I was thinking, well, that's part of, I think, what we do when you're not just sort of making generic jokes about, I don't know what, like two guys sit in a bar. You know, if you're like making jokes that are more personal, I think that you do reach people in a different way, you know, that people do think sometimes that they know you or they connect with you. And I think as long as somebody's not, you know, camping on my lawn or something, it's like, oh, that's all right.
Yeah.
You know?
There are some people camping on your lawn right now.
Yeah, but it's not because of me.
Right.
It's because of our lawn. It's really great.
It is a nice lawn.
Yeah.
So when you started to, the impulse to do this, the impulse to draw cartoons, probably wasn't necessarily an impulse to reach out and touch people's lives.
No.
So is there a way that you can describe what the impulse was?
I think I always liked cartoons. I always liked it when something made me laugh.
Mm.
And I think I always, my drawings could make me laugh, and sometimes they made other people laugh. And that sort of interaction was always really interesting to me, even from when I was a little kid. And I always drew. I always drew from the time I was like, you know, two or three, you know, before I was writing, I wanted to draw. I think most little kids do, but they just sort of stop somewhere along the way. But I did start when I was young to notice that I really liked things that made me laugh. I mean, I would make up funny recipes, and I would sometimes, you know, some kid would want, let's go outside and play. It's like, no, let's make up like books of funny recipes. Let's cut, you know, stupid stuff out of magazines and make fun of it and, you know, just make jokes and make each other laugh. So I always like to do that.
And it seems as though, we're going to talk to Sue from Windsor in just a second, but it seems as though also that you had a sense, more than a lot of other cartoonists do, that words are funny. I mean, your cartoons often have a lot of words in them.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I mean, one thing about New Yorker cartoons that's interesting is that back in the olden days, there used to be a person who was people who were gag writers, and then there were artists.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Arno, I think he probably never wrote any of his own jokes. He bought gags from gag writers. Charles Adams bought gags. Most of these old guys bought gags from gag writers. And somewhere in the 1960s, this started to change, where the artist and the gag writer became one and the same person. So, yeah, for me, another thing I love about cartoons is not only is the point of it, you know, to make jokes, but also that it's a combination of words and pictures. And yeah, I mean, I think words can be really funny, you know, individual words, but also the timing of the whole thing and the way something is said.
Looking at one of your New Yorker covers in preparation for the show, I laughed just at the phrase veal cutlet. There's something funny about the phrase veal cutlet.
There is something funny. Veal cutlet.
Veal cutlet. And you don't hear it so much anymore, too. I think it was a period term. I don't think you've been in a restaurant in a long time where somebody offered you a veal cutlet.
No. They call them like veal medallions, which I love because I think like, yes, what's that lovely brooch? It's a veal medallion.
Yes, it's something I won.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's a little piece of veal.
A little piece of veal.
Yeah.
You know, safety pin to my blouse. It's a veal medallion.
We've got a call from Sue in Windsor. Hi, Sue. You're on the
air.
Hi.
Roz, it's great to talk to you. I so appreciate your book. I just wanted to tell you, my husband and I are going through caring for aging parents right now, and our best friends are as well, and I gave them a copy of your book. They moved to New Orleans recently, and it's been so great for the four of us to have it in common, just to help us sort of vent our frustration and exasperation as we deal with all of the stuff that I'm sure you can relate to. And I just so appreciate that you're willing to be honest about how lousy it is to be in this position. I mean, it's wonderful to be able to care for your parents on one level, but it's just been so great for the four of us to hear and see someone else say, this stinks, I hate it, I hate the disruption to my life. You know, just the honesty of it is just not lost on us, and we so appreciate it. And I wanted to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for letting me know.
I mean, one of the things that I think your book gets at in a really interesting way is that transition to becoming the boss of your parents. Although you are the boss of your parents at a certain point. If you have to put them in place into a place, capital P, if you have to make these kinds of decisions, you wind up trying to be the boss of your parents, but they don't think you're the boss. And the push and pull between those two things. There are even moments of exhilaration being the boss of the person who was the boss of you for so long, but it's always balanced out by their complete anarchy and insidious rebellion. Yeah.
And it's also just enormously sad. And it's sad for them. It's sad for yourself. And you also, you know, become aware in this very profound way that this is the direction that, you know, that you're headed as well. And, you know, it's not like, oh, my poor parents, and this is just terrible, but it won't happen to me. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, this is what happens. This is what happens at the end of life. If you're lucky, you know, if an anvil doesn't fall out of the sky on you, or if you don't, like, you know, you're going along in your 50s or 60s and you get some terrible disease and you're, you know, out, you know, if you are lucky and chances are you are going to, especially nowadays, it seems like people are living longer. There's a very good chance that you're going to be living, you know, well into your 80s, if not your 90s, if not 100. And those are years where you just become increasingly dependent on other people, on, you know, on society in a certain way, on your children, which is really scary. And, you know, there's a lot of things that it stirs up, I think.
There's a great little cartoon in the book about why you don't want to live to be 102. That's really, it's visual. I can't really express it, but it really kind of gets at that. So let's talk about something happier.
Yes.
Can't we talk about something a little bit more pleasant? So let's talk about going up to Stockbridge and going to this wonderful museum and seeing not just Roz Chast cartoons, Jeremy, but also eggs, right? Eggs and rugs?
Eggs and rugs.
Yeah. Eggs and rugs. That's like, those are the ingredients to a happy summer afternoon, right? Yeah. What else? What is there?
Eggs and rugs? Yeah. Yeah.
So tell us about the eggs and rugs. She can tell us, but you as the museum guy, you give us kind of a sense. What will we see when we get up there?
Well, it's really interesting. I think you're right that people expecting to just see the cartoons are in for a surprise because you really see sort of into the window of your home and studio. I actually created a video for the exhibit, and so I had a little preview about what was to come. So we have some objects of various art, other forms of media that Roz works in, the Pysanky eggs.
Yeah, this is I've always loved the Pysanky eggs. I loved the intricacy, the detail, and the brilliant colors. And I met somebody who taught me the technique. They're not painted, they're dyed. And you work with a little tool where you melt wax, and it's like batik. You're drawing on it's just a chicken egg, you know, regular egg. And you draw on the egg with the wax, and then when you put it in the dye, of course, the dye adheres to wherever the wax isn't. So you're working sort of in the negative, and then you just dip it into subsequent vats of dye going from the lightest shade. You go from white, your very first dip, to like maybe the first thing will be yellow, then white, yellow, orange, red. And I just love it. I love that, you know, it's just very mesmerizing for me. And they break all the time. It's just the way it is with when you're working with eggs. And I also do these, I guess it's called primitive rug hooking, mm-hmm. which is I do my own designs. You can buy these like sort of terrible, corny, awful kits where, you know, there'll be like a design, usually some cliched thing like a cat or like fruit or something. And then it comes with pre-cut pieces of yarn. But again, I met somebody, a friend of mine who knew how to do it. And I said, teach me. And the technique of this is actually very simple. It's just really you have a piece of burlap which you stretch over a frame, and then you're pushing these loops of wool strips through the little, you know, the weave of the burlap. But colonists and I guess like pilgrims and people like that, this is where it was invented. This is why it's called primitive rug hooking. It's a kind of early American folk art because they didn't want to waste anything. Like they couldn't go to Kohl's and pick up a shirt for like, you know, 59 cents where you're thinking like, I don't get this. The fabric costs more than 59 cents. How can this shirt be 59 cents? But you know, every piece of clothing was valuable. So when a shirt got like really tattered and it couldn't be patched anymore, the women would cut it up into strips, you know, maybe like a quarter of an inch wide or a third of an inch wide. And then they would push it up through the burlap and they would make these rugs. It's like quilting, you know, like they used every piece of everything they had. So anyway, I make these rugs
But there, I mean, we should say that both the eggs and the rugs are very much in the mode of Chast.
They're so. My cartoons. I mean, yeah. They're not like some weird deviation or something. I haven't like suddenly decided, yes, a bowl of fruit is exactly what I've always wanted to, you know, spend hours and hours painting this bowl of fruit. No, they're my characters. I mean, I use my, my stuff happens to translate very well to these mediums. I've tried other things; it doesn't work quite as well. But these particular things, and it's also color, you know. And I love working with color, so that's a part of the fun of it.
I'm looking at a picture of the hand hooked rug that features cans, a can of carrots, looking over at a can of beans. You have kind of a thing about cans, right?
I do. I love cans. I love can labels. I really, really like that. And I'm not quite sure why, but I like labels. In fact, the thing that I'm sort of really obsessed with right now is Japanese matchbox labels from the 1920s to the 1940s. And I don't even want to tell you how many hours I've spent, you know, trawling eBay for. I don't want to own any of them because, you know, one thing I learned from the experience of cleaning up my parents' apartment was like, I don't want more stuff. But, you know, I just like collect the JPEGs and then make arrangements out of them. And it's nuts. It's totally nuts. I've spent probably easily a couple of hundred hours on this like stupid mania, which I have no idea where it's going to go, but maybe it'll go someplace. I don't know.
Well, I mean, back to the other thing about the can labels too, is they are things where someone has gone to some trouble to ingratiate this product with you, with your eyes.
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, sometimes I have a collection of these cans, and my rule is they still have to be available in the supermarket. Although occasionally somebody will send me a can, and it's so great that I have to break my rule. But especially the older ones, it'll be like this bowl with like canned potatoes for some reason, which is like the most revolting thing I can think of. I mean, why? Potatoes in a can is disgusting. I mean, you have to admit it. And the water that the potatoes are in, it's just nasty. But anyway, the labels, sometimes you'll have this, you know, and the artist, some anonymous artist made this beautiful label. And, you know, the potatoes were arranged just so in like a blue bowl with like fluted edges, and they chose like exactly the lettering. I don't know. I just really like it a lot. So, yeah.
I think it's healthy to have a love of everyday things, you know.
You got to, as I said, keep your expectations low. Right. You're not going to get that Brock.
Right.
You know, that Edward Hopper painting?
No.
Probably not.
What I've realized lately that I have an appreciation of, and I talk about it every time I come down here, because I go to this coffee shop next door, and you get your coffee, and you know those sort of corrugated, they're not corrugated, those trays where they have little holes where you press the coffee into.
Yes.
And the hole resists the coffee cup just a little bit so that you jam it in there.
Yes.
Those are great.
Aren't
they great?
Yeah, they are great.
People just, before they existed, people just walked around with brown stains all over themselves because you couldn't
scalded,
carry.
Big blisters of scalding. And
You understand, yes.
Yes. That's a nice piece of engineering.
Right.
There.
Some inventor was down in the basement every night, you know, his wife is upstairs saying, are you coming? No, I'm almost there. I've almost got this.
Yes.
And it's going to work.
It's not. Yeah.
But it does. It's one of those things that works. It actually is thing that makes us happy. So, you know, in terms of shaping that sense of humor that we're also familiar with from you, Growing up, who did you think was funny? Did you watch television? Did you watch movies? Did you, I mean, like, what made you laugh as a little kid?
Oh, when I was a little kid, Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I loved Mad Magazine as a kid. It was so irreverent, and it made fun of these ads. And I think it really sort of taught a lot of us of our generation, like, if you didn't think these ads were stupid to begin with, now you really saw them, you know. I mean, I remember seeing there was some ad for, like, it was making fun of Chase and Sanborn coffee, but they called it cheese and sandbag. And when I was a kid, I just thought that was, like, I could just think of that by myself and just start laughing, like, cheese and sandbag. That's really, you know, I don't know.
I've mentioned this before on the show. I really did regard Mad Magazine, once again, we had the childhood of the same era, is this kind of almost Promethean secret that I was being conferred upon me, that because, you know, we grew up in the Eisenhower and Kennedy eras where you really weren't invited to question things very much.
Right.
And
right.
So when you picked up Mad Magazine and started reading it, basically they said, you know, all this stuff, it's all crap.
It's so stupid. And the people who believe that this is real, they're stupid. They're really. And I think that was like, it wasn't just that it was crap. It was like, it was very pointed. It was like, if you don't see through this, you are really, you're just, your brain dead. And I just loved that. I also love Charles Adams. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really discover him. And my parents were New Yorker subscribers. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I was a little kid, I would pick up the magazine and it was kind of off-putting because I would look at the cartoons, but most of them I didn't quite get. And it was very text heavy. But when I was young, when I was about 9, 10, my parents used to go to, in the summer, they would go with a contingent of Brooklyn school teachers up to Ithaca, New York, they would go to Cornell University. I'm not quite sure, like, why Ithaca, but this whole group of Brooklyn school teachers, most of whom did not have children, I was an exception. They were like my parents' old friends. They would go up. They would live in cheap student houses, and they would go during the day. They'd go to concerts. They'd go to lectures, and sometimes they would just be my parents would want to be with their friends, and they would like park me in the browsing library there was a student center there called Willard Strait. And this browsing library had a section of cartoon books. And I spent many hours there, and I really fixated on the Charles Adams books, Monster Rally, Adams and Evil, Black Mariah. They were just so hilariously funny to me. So, and again, something a little bit like Mad Magazine, something a little bit, you know, subversive and, but cheery, you know. They weren't like, it wasn't like, you know, society must die because, you know, it was just like, this is really, this like happy family stuff. I said a bad
word. That's all right.
All right.
We're all friends here.
Okay, yeah, well, you can beep it or whatever. And I loved it. Loved it.
The, you know, those books were, we're going to have to take a break here, but those books, some of those books were around my house too. And there was something simultaneously subversive and reassuring about
them. You had them around your house.
Yeah, my parents had a couple of them. Yeah, I'm sure they were my father's. And I do remember the really famous Adams cartoon of the movie theater where everyone is weeping copiously.
Yeah.
You can't see what's on the screen. You just see the audience and they're all weeping, except there's this kind of Uncle Fester kind of guy who's smiling. He's cackling. You know, whatever it is that everybody else is crying about, he's loving it. All right, so we're going to take a break. We're going to come back with, boy, this show is zooming by, with Roz Chast and Jeremy Clough. We'll tell you more about what's up at the Norman Rockwell Museum and other stuff.
Today's show was produced by Lydia Brown, Jonathan McPants, and me, Kyone Wolf, with mega help from Alex Dubin. Thanks also to Gina Matruda and Tucker Ives, back at the Mothership. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Zippy the Pinhead. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff worrying about the long-term health effects of truffle oil, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. Tomorrow, we're resharing our show about dragons. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, for reasons that would be so complicated to explain that I won't even try, we have to tape a different show tomorrow at 1. So, but we can't put it on the air, not at that time. So we're going to, we did a great show about dragons. At least we thought it was a great show about dragons a few months ago. And so we're going to do that instead. So you will know a lot more about dragons. Today, we're talking to Roz Chass, legendary New Yorker cartoonist, author of many books, including most recently her award-winning graphic memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Also with us, Jeremy Clough. He's the manager of media services at the Norman Rockwell Museum, where in fact, Roz Chass' work and life are kind of on exhibit. Roz Chass' cartoon memoirs is on view at the Norman Rockwell Museum now through October 26. It's a beautiful drive up there, and you should just do it. The exhibit's part of the museum's Distinguished Illustrator Exhibition Series. And since we're pausing on that, I'd like to ask you both a little bit about that notion. So, you know, I think people look at cartoonists and say, well, they're cartoonists as opposed to artists. Do you think of yourself as a good artist?
I don't think I'm a terribly good draftsman, no. I think I'm really limited, in fact. Try, and I think I'm getting better. I think I have a lot of limitations.
Although, I mean, one of the measures of an artist can be, did they introduce us to an entirely new visual signature? And you've absolutely done that, right? I mean, there just wasn't anything that looked anything like what
yeah.
you do.
I think I have my own style.
Yeah. Jeremy, is there anything you can say about how the museum decided that Roz Chast was one of the people you wanted in this series?
Well, we had done a show about 10 years ago, New Yorker cover exhibition, mm-hmm. which Roz was a part of. And I guess that's where we made the first connection with you. And, you know, went over so well. And we know the crowds that come through. They mm-hmm. enjoy laughing at Rockwell's art. Mm-hmm. So humor is very much a part of our, you know, everyday scene in a good way. You know, I mean, people are, they're kind of taking a breath and, enjoying themselves. So I think there's the connection that, and you've talked about it, Roz, during the course of this exhibit, is that it's sort of a everyday moments that have been elevated into something extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And, you have a different take, but I think there is a through line, you know, from Rockwell to you.
Well, I think Bob Mankoff had said something in some interview about that one thing that humor does is it takes things that are little and makes them big, but it also takes like big things and makes them kind of little. And I think that's kind of a funny thought to think about.
William Hamilton one time said to me that part of the humor of some cartoons, he was talking about his own cartoons, was the tension that exists between the effort that went into drawing something about such a flimsy concept, that it took for him to make the picture that went with this kind of this little idea was he thought sort of some of the funniness of the cartoon. I'm not inviting you to. To agree with that sentiment. I don't think it really applies to your cartooning, but it's that same kind of thing in a way. I want to just sort of go back to sort of influences that shaped you a little bit. I mean, did you laugh at television and movies?
I did. You know, when I was a little kid, I watched all those cartoons when I was a kid. I have a very vivid memory of being on the couch and, you know, when my ankle hit the edge of the sofa cushion, mm-hmm. and I was sort of waiting for like the point where like my knee bent where the sofa cushion bent, and it hadn't gotten to that point yet. And I watched those like horribly violent cartoons that I know, you know, Ren and Stimpy on The Simpsons are all based on, mm-hmm. and that's why I love The Simpsons, and I really love the Ren and Stimpy cartoons because they are exactly like the cartoons that we watch where, you know, these animals were always getting, like, flayed alive or, like, an anvil would drop on them and a steamroller would go over them and, you know, they'd be set on fire and, like, the cigar would explode and they'd be, like, a black skeleton and then, you know, suddenly, miraculously, they'd be fine. But that's, you know, that all that stuff, I think, I grew up on.
I think also, you know, the Warner Brothers, the Looney Tunes cartoons were very they were kind of modernist in a way that they were sometimes very aware of the fact that they were cartoons.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And a lot of the jokes that they made, you know, I didn't even see them. I didn't even get them until I was older.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I watch like old Betty Boop cartoons on YouTube and I'm like, oh my God, they got away with a lot. But I also watched sitcoms. I mean, I remember going through a phase where I just thought like Bewitched was, you know, Green Acres, that these things were just the bee's knees, you know. And then, of course, you get to an age where you watch it and you think, I hate life. I hate people. I hate, you know, this planet. I hate this universe. This is just, you know, the whole thing. But, you know, when I was about 9, you know, Bewitched was great.
Yeah. I used to watch Rocky and Bullwinkle with my father, and he would laugh at completely different jokes from what I laughed at.
Yeah, well, how were we to know that, like, you know, Boris Badenoff was, you know, based on Boris Godunov? Or, I mean, I remember that there was a little supermarket in Brooklyn that my mother used to go to, and this supermarket was just, like, the grimmest, darkest, horriblest old Brooklyn supermarket place. And it was called the Brothers Chermarinsky, but my mother always called it the Brothers Karamazov. You know, there are jokes that parents make that you don't get until you're older.
Oh, absolutely. I love the portrait of your parents in Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And it does, you know, once again, I was talking about this recently, about the sort of the greatest generation, right? And
I think they were before that.
They might have been a little bit, yeah.
They were both born in 1912.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, sure.
What I noticed with my parents, who are pretty much of a similar generation, I was also the child of somewhat older parents, was that they had kind of had this attitude of like, you know, we went through the Depression and World War II, so just don't bother us for about 20 years.
Yeah, like, it was really just, it was, you know, put up or shut up.
Yeah.
And, you know, for my mother, a lot of, if you had like too many problems, it was like, it was because you were staring at your navel, you know, and it was like, stop staring at your navel, you know. So, you know, they had a very different, it was a very different take. If you had a roof over your head and you had food and you had clothes, shut up.
So many of your cartoons seem to be about having a mother, but also about being a mother. Are you in a constant struggle not to be a certain kind of mother?
I think you're always, as a parent, you're always in a constant struggle to not be like the kind of mother you wouldn't want and the kind of person that you don't want to be. If that's just like a general, you know, state of mind, not even just a parent, you know, you're always, I mean, I feel like I'm always in a struggle to not be a person that I don't want to be, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think when I had children, I was very aware that I wanted to be a different kind of parent.
Mm-hmm. What kind of, we only have 2 minutes left, but so, when they do their version of Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, how do you think they'll depict you?
Well, I told my daughter everything is material, you know, and I don't have a leg to stand on here as far as saying like anything is, you know, private or don't say this or don't say that. You know, really everything is material and feel free to use it, you know, do what you want mm-hmm. with it. So
that's a great attitude. You may come to regret it someday, but it's a great attitude.
Oh, I regret it already, but, you know, what can I do?
I regret it already sounds like the title of the next Roz Chast collection. So many more things I would have loved to have asked you, but we really are kind of running out of time here. I want to, first of all, thank Roz Chast for coming all the way to New Haven. I want to thank Jeremy Clough, who's the manager of media services at the Norman Rockwell Museum, for getting Roz Chast to New Haven. And once again, remind you that not only is the memoir Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant available and ready to guide you through the inferno that you might be walking through pretty soon with your parents, or maybe as that parent walking through a different kind of inferno, but you can also go up to the beautiful Norman Rockwell Museum in the beautiful Berkshires now through October 26th and see that wonderful exhibit, Roz Chast Cartoon Memoirs. I want to thank everybody, especially our friend here in New Haven, Jonathan McPants, who's been on the board today. Lydia Brown produced this show. We'll be back tomorrow with dragons. Actually, I'll be doing something completely different. I won't be talking about dragons, but you just won't know what I'm talking about.
Why were all the hoity-toity art historians so crazy about this junk when Norman Rockwell was just making these wonderful, wonderful pictures? Making these wonderful pictures.
Wolfie, you still stuck in that Roz Chast cartoon?
Yeah.
You want me to break you out?
No, pencil gray actually looks pretty good on me, but of course, not that good.